Welcome back to another episode of Better Than I Found It, the podcast all things college golf. You're listening to Mike McGraw, the men's golf coach at Baylor University. Today's episode will be something a little different. Today, my guest is Oklahoma State Golf Sports Information Director, Ryan Cameron. Ryan has been a really good friend of mine for over 25 years, and he is truly obsessed with college golf. Now, obsessed in a very good way. What's different about today's interview is that Ryan will be asking all the questions. He wanted it that way, and I'm giving the responses. I guess now you'll get to see how quickly I can think on my feet. I hope you enjoy. Okay, Better Than I Found It listeners, Ryan Cameron, the Assistant Director of Athletic Communications at Oklahoma State University, is my guest today. Ryan is a very dear friend of mine going back over 25 years. And Ryan, we've wanted to do this podcast for a long time, but you actually had an idea to turn this podcast on its ear upside down. Tell me about it.
Well, I've been working long and hard trying to figure out a way to get on your podcast because I'm not exactly distinguished in the game of golf. So people are wondering what in the heck I'm doing here. So being what I am, I had to get a little bit creative. And I thought, well, you know what? Nobody ever interviews the podcaster. Mm-hmm. So why not flip the script a little bit and sit down? And you're right. As long as you and I have known each other, I thought about it. I was like, we had never really sat down and done an in-depth any kind of interview. We talked about a lot of stuff, but we had never really done kind of a formal interview. And I thought this would be fun to do because we never did it during your time here or any. And, you know, we've obviously stayed in contact since you've left Stillwater, but any point along the way, we never sat down and did anything like this.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. And I'm sure you've got some curveballs for me that, you know, I'm kind of a professional, but I'm really sort of a mid-amateur at this. So I don't know what you've got prepared for me, but let's get going.
Let's do it. For those that haven't had the pleasure, I remember way back in the day, this was when I was first getting started in this, I got to take the famed Ponca City tour with you.
That's a good one.
You took me back to your old stomping grounds, and we got to see some of the places you grew up, but it's funny because we've talked about your dad some, and I knew how important he was, but I'd never really talked to you about what it was like, because you grew up in a fairly big family, I'd say, correct?
Yes, seven kids.
Yep. Seven kids, and how many of those kids ended up, I'd say you were kind of born into golf, right? But not everybody fell into golf, so with your dad working in golf, how did you end up in golf and not everybody else in the family did?
Well, he started all seven kids at age five. So you take them to the, you know, I think we had 10 Friday mornings in the summer. You do a little clinic for a couple hours, play a little bit, whatever, and then have a tournament in August. He took all of us out there at age five. I was the only one that did not want to play. All the rest of them wanted to play a little bit, but they all kind of worked their way away from the game. You know, Debbie, my oldest sister, became a clinical psychologist. Vicky was a creative person, you know, arts and crafts type person. Sherry was an artist. Sandy became a teacher. Tim became a club repairman. And my sister, Patty, played a lot of really good competitive golf. But I was the only one that didn't play at five. I hated it. I could not get away from it fast enough. And finally, when I did come back to the game at age nine, it was something I wanted to do forever. And I'll credit my dad because if he had forced golf on me, I wouldn't have been in golf. There's no way. So
what was it? What was it that brought you back to the game?
Boredom. I mean, there's only so many crawdads you can go saning for and only so many, you know, rocks you can pick up in the yard. I mean, I just had nothing to do at the house. It was very boring. And I thought, well, Dad goes every day to the golf course. I'll go with him and see what that's like. And man, I was hooked from the start. I couldn't hit enough golf balls. And my little buddy, Mark Powell, who was a year older than me, but we were best buddies. We either were looking for golf balls in the canyons and creeks, playing golf, or hitting practice balls or chipping and putting. It was literally before daylight until after dark every day. And Mark became a very good junior player. I think he finished third in the junior world and did some other good things in the game and is still in the game as a club professional today. But I couldn't get enough of it. So it's just like I was bored. So I went out and took golf. And by the way, if you're bored, golf is something you can do alone and get a lot of pleasure out of because you just keep getting hit golf shots. So
was it an immediate switch that flipped because you went from not liking it to going back to it? And then you say you were hooked. Was there a specific moment or anything in that time that hooked you?
Not a specific moment, but I think that when my brother won the state junior, and I think he was 11 or 12 when he won, I think he was 12. He won the state junior. I thought, wow, he's pretty famous already. He's winning the state junior. Surely that's something I could do. And Patty was already playing good golf. All my other sisters had worked their way away from the game at that time. But if I stayed at home, I was with a bunch of girls. So I had to go to the golf course where I could, get the competitive juices flowing and get out there and play some golf and compete. And like I said, I ran into Mark Powell. His dad was a member at the club. And gosh, Mark hit practice balls every day. So not a specific moment, but I do think Tim inspired me when he won the state junior.
So, we've talked about, I mean, obviously your dad, and you're like most people, you have great affection for your dad. And what impact did he have on your golf game and getting you where you are? What, you know, how did he factor into that? He was obviously, that was his livelihood, but as far as you guys, what did he bring to that?
What he brought to it was, first of all, it was something he did outside of actually playing and practicing the game. That was just the way he worked at the club. 6 days a week, he was daylight to dark. He opened the shop. He closed the shop. He didn't really have an assistant pro until he was about 40. You know, he pretty much did everything, finally got an assistant pro. So I watched his work ethic, which was great. And I just literally starved to take a golf lesson from him. He was too busy to, you know, it wasn't like I got a lesson every day. If I got a lesson a month, that was a lot. And he would just pour into my game, very simple, quiet, soft wisdom. And it was like, I really like that. I felt good or better after every lesson I took with my dad. So, and then I caddied for him. He would give me a silver John F. Kennedy 50-cent piece. He had tons of those, actual silver ones, 1964 or before. And every time I caddied 18 holes, I got one of those. And I thought that was amazing. And he'd also buy me a Coke and a package of, you know, cheese crackers or something at the turn. I really enjoyed just caddying and being around him and working with him every day. So his influence on work ethic was from the start. And then just watching him play, he was still a good player. He had played in a U.S. Open when he was 19. He was a nice player. When he started having children, there wasn't a career in golf and there wasn't any money at the time anyway. But I just think his influence on me just was so good in the way he did that. And one time I remember he was playing and I wasn't caddying for him. And he made the turn and he walked in the golf shop. And I said, "Dad, how are you playing?" And he said, "Well, I have no idea." And I said, "Dad, you just played 9 holes. Surely you know how you're playing." He says, "No, you can't add them up until the end. I'll tell you when I'm finished exactly how I'm playing. I don't know." And he was trying to plant a seed. And, you know, if I catch myself asking a guy how he stands in a round of golf, it's a big mistake. It's stupid. Why do that? You just play the round of golf, be in the moment. He taught me that at a very young age. So his influence on me was the way he carried himself.
It's funny that you bring that last point up. That's one of the many things that you've passed on to me. I remember you telling me that one time. UK, I don't know if you remember Brad Schiller and I playing, and you came and walked with us at Lakeside.
I do.
And
wasn't Brad getting ready to move back to Australia?
Ready to move back to Australia, and you and I, and I don't even know why it came up, but you brought that up about golf and said, you know, hit it, chase it, and add it up at the end. And that's always stuck with me, to just play and not worry about it. And it's funny because I passed that on to our good buddy Kyle Briggs. You know, he got the golf bug and he would get consumed by score. And I kept telling him that. And every time he would get close, it was funny. The first time he was close to beating me, we're standing on 18T at Lakeside. And he said, "You realize if I par this hole, I'm going to beat you." And he didn't. And I told him afterwards, I said, "You need to talk to Coach McGraw because you started thinking about numbers." Last year, again, we've got a guy here in the department, and he's a good player. I've played with him. He plays in our Monday game. And I was playing in the group in front of him, and he I didn't know this at the time, but he had never broken 70. And he had about three holes to go, and he started thinking about it. And he threw in a double square and shot 71. And so we're standing on 18, we're right there behind 18 green at Lakeside.
Yep.
And I used the Coach McGraw, and I said, I'm going to tell you something. And I said, and he said, man, and he was pretty distraught because he had played well. And I said, I'm going to teach you what Coach McGraw taught me. And I told him that, and he's like, you know what, you're right. So whenever we go back this summer, we'll see if he can do that. But anyway, I have passed on that lesson, so you'll know that I've been passing on your wisdom to others. But it's funny to watch people get consumed in that.
Well, you know, you bring that up, and Charles Howell III was the best junior golfer in the country. He almost beat Tiger Woods in one of those U.S. amateurs when he was 16. He was a great player, and he came in, and by the way, in 3 years at Carson Creek, he never shot an 80, 79 or lower every round in all that weather, all the things that happened. So that's remarkable that you could play three straight years and never shoot 80. But it was deep into his freshman year, and he hadn't broken 70 yet. And he routinely shot in the 60s as a junior golfer. And Mike Holder noticed one day, says, Charles, you've had three chances to break 70 now, and you've done something bad on 17 or 18 every single time. He said, yeah, I just want to break 70 so bad. And so Mike said privately to me, he said, Coach McGraw, you and I, one of the two of us will be on 17 green for the rest of it, or 17 tee for the rest of his career. I said, what do you mean? He says, we're teach that guy not to think about score. And so sure enough, Charles was 3 under through 16 the very next round. 17's a hard hole, but 18's a birdie hole. So you got to feel like you're going to bust 70 there. Mike said, Charles, how do you stand? And he said, I'm 3 under, coach. I'm going to break 70 today. He said, not with me here, you're not. And so Mike talked him into a couple of bogeys or something stupid, didn't break 70, and Charles was furious. So this happened and repeated itself over and over and over, probably five or six more times. And we were at a tournament one time, and Charles's dad, Dr. Howell, was at the tournament. How's everything going back in Stillwater? He said. And Charles says, well, I'm so mad at Coach Holder right now. And he said, why are you mad at Coach? He says, well, the other day I had a chance to break 70 for the first time at Carson Creek, and he talked me out of it. And I'm just so mad at him. I don't know why he does that. I have no idea why he's doing this to me. It doesn't make sense. And his dad said, son, if you're letting a man talking to you get in your head and you can't break 70 because of him, you've got a long way to go as a player. So you better figure it out. And sure enough, I mean, Charles thought, well, at least I'll get dad on my side. Nope. He was like right with Mike Holder, like, you can't win this battle. How are you going to beat a tour pro one day? And sure enough, Charles eventually broke 70. But I can't imagine anybody playing 3 years without shooting an 80 at Carson Creek.
I'd like to say I was close. I'm just happy when I do break 80 out there. So I've done it a few times, and it's like that golf ball goes on the mantle, you know. At what point in your when you're playing and you're growing up, did you think I can do this and maybe go to college and do this or play beyond? At what point did you start to feel like you could do that?
I think it was in the seventh grade. I had been playing for about 3 years at that point. Yeah, right at 3 years. And my brother Tim had won the Texas Oklahoma Junior now. So he won the state junior in Oklahoma a couple of times and won the Texas Oklahoma Junior. And I thought, this is a real deal. He's going to play college golf. And he got recruited by several big schools. And so it was in the seventh grade that I realized, okay, I just have to play junior high golf, and then I have to play high school golf, and I'll find my way to a campus one day. And so I remember it being in the spring of my seventh grade year.
So what led you to Edmond and UCO and your career there?
Well, I got recruited originally at Odessa Junior College. And the reason I went to Odessa, one, it was a great coach. Barry Rodenhaver was awesome. But it was the only place where I had a full ride. And I had promised my parents I would pay for my education. Dumb move. Bad move. Because I was too proud to let them join in on the deal. So I had to have a full scholarship. So I went there, spent a year there, and then I left after 1 year and went to Central Oklahoma. It was I don't even know the recruiting rules in those days or how it worked. But anyway, I was able to transfer and spent 3 great years at UCO. At the time, it was Central State, and had played it with 2 guys. One of them, Robin Freeman, played the PGA Tour for 15 or 20 years, and his brother, Jeff, eventually made the Champions Tour. So we had great players. And Scott Templeton was a runner-up in the U.S. Junior 1 year. So we had all those guys at one spot, and we had a great team. I loved my time at Central Oklahoma. We didn't have a coach. We had the athletic director who would get other coaches to drive us, and then Art Proctor, the head pro at Kicking Bird, would help us with our game. But we didn't have an official coach. So it was truly 5 or 6 or 7 guys figuring it out on their own.
When you see, and you touched on your sister Patty, who obviously has had a tremendous career, and I used to joke with you all the time about what was it like to be the second best player out of that pair of twins there. What was it like with her? How did she push you? What was the dynamic like between the two of you being competitive players and both being good players? What was that like growing up with a twin sister that was as talented as she was? And what was the benefit of that, I guess, for both of you?
Well, the benefit was you don't dare lose to your sister. You shouldn't do that. That would be bad. But she was a different player than I was. I was out grinding it out for 7 or 8 hours a day, just hitting all those golf balls and doing everything. And she was very natural. She liked to go to the pool, eat a cheeseburger, hang out with her friends at the pool. Then she might go on a field trip. She might stay at home for a day or two. She might, but she played golf. She went out to play, and she never picked up on a hole. She always finished out every hole, which I think I've still never met anybody that did that. She started a hole, she finished a hole. And it didn't matter what the score was, if she was playing or practicing, she always finished a hole. And I always felt like that was a benefit she had in match play, because she always felt like she had to stay in the game. And it didn't matter if you hit it in the hazard, I still have a chance to win this hole. And so she did that. She inspired me that way, but she also inspired me just the way she made golf look easy. And I didn't make it look easy. It was always hard for me, but I don't know. Just having a twin that was close, most would say, well, were you jealous of her success when you were having less? No, I was thrilled. I saw her out of her 9 Oklahoma State Women's Amateur Championships. I was there for 8 of them. I couldn't make it 1 year. I was either traveling or something. I don't know why, but I saw all of her state championships basically because we were so proud that she was doing well. And funny thing about Patty, when she got out of college, I think she'd won 3 or so before then, but she was a mother. And so she was raising children, and about May 15th, she'd take out her golf clubs and she'd practice for a month and she'd go win the state amateur and then put the clubs up for a year because she was raising children. She didn't have time to play golf. So she inspired me with how easily she made the game look, and I was not jealous of her. I was happy for her.
That's always been amazing to me, the people that could do that, because I consider myself a decent athlete back in the day, and I could do a lot of things. But, boy, I tell you what, if I haven't been playing golf, you can tell I haven't been playing. So for somebody to be able to do that, who has, you know, and I've probably talked to you about this. I know whenever I do interviews with I've talked to any of our crew that's come over, you know, the Alex Norins, the Parr Nielsens, our girl Karin Sajodin, as we call her, you know, yeah, the over pronunciation, you know, even Victor Hovland, when I talked to him about this, anybody that's from one of those countries like that, I've marveled at the success, you know, the Swedes have had in golf, because it's just, you know, they don't get to play year round. And it's such a hard game. And so for them to be able to develop that skill set and do that, I've always marveled at that crew. You know, the Anders Holtmans of the world, you know, you guys brought over countless players. I've always had a great appreciation, because I just, that would have been so hard for me. The rust comes back so fast because it's such a hard game. But I didn't know that about her, about putting the clubs up. So that's even more impressive with all those state titles.
She was unbelievable. You know, it does pay, it gives credence to the intentional work. So she would take the clubs out a month before her. She was very intentional. Okay, I've got only so much time still to practice every day. She got the right work done the right way and just built her feel into the game, back into her game again. Now, eventually, the lack of, you know, playing will eventually, you can't you can't do that into your 40s and 50s very easily because you just aren't as strong as you once were or whatever. But she was very intentional with her practice and her play. I think our players should do a better job of that on any college golf team. Just hitting 300 golf balls doesn't mean anything. You've got to go out and work on it with some purpose. And that's why I make our guys actually have a practice card when they have a player's choice practice. They have to fill it out minute by minute what they do over the 3 hours. I want them to know that we think it's important that you work at the game with intention. And my sister, Patty, boy, she could do that.
It's funny that brings up it makes me think of a point. I was in Fort Worth for the Hogan Award a couple of years ago, and I was in the lobby of the hotel and I talked to Coach Sands. He was there, you know, Texas Tech, and obviously Ludwig was there, and I was there with Eugenio, and we were getting ready to go to Colonial. You know how you have that day you get to go over to the golf course. Right. So we're in the lobby, and Coach came over, and we were talking, and we started talking about Ludwig. And that day, I've been lucky, you know, on that deal. They've started inviting SIDs, and so I get to go. Allen's let me caddy the 9 holes for that deal, so I got to carry for Eugenio that day. And so that was going to be the first time I'd seen Ludwig play in person. And I wanted to see this kid, and so I was asking Coach about it, and he said, you know, he said, Ryan, he's an amazing kid. He said, I'm going to tell you, he's unique. It says he doesn't have a lot of wasted time. He said he's very efficient in what he does. He said he comes to the golf course, and he may only be there a couple of hours. He said it's not because he's lazy. He said he shows up and he gets his work done. He knows exactly what he wants to work on and he gets his work done. He doesn't mess around and there's not a lot of wasted time, and he gets done what he needs to get done. And then he goes and takes care of his schoolwork and watches European soccer. So, you know, I thought that was kind of interesting that, you know, he was able to come in. His way of doing it was, I'm going to come in and get my work done, and I don't need to be out here wasting time. But you know, just the level of efficiency, and you see obviously where he's gotten in the game. So
I think Ludwig was one of the most prepared college players coming into pro golf since Tiger. I mean, he had the maturity level that, so whereas some of the skills might have been a little bit behind Tiger, possibly, he's a better wedge player than Tiger coming out of college, that's for sure. But Tiger became a great wedge player. But the point is, he was very ready to play pro golf.
So I want to talk about a guy that you and I have had some conversations with. This is about one of your, I guess, heroes growing up, Ben Hogan.
Mm-hmm.
And your great affection for Ben Hogan. Where did that stem from? Where did that come from? And what was it about him that drew you to him?
Well, Ben Hogan was no longer playing competitive golf, basically, by the time I took up the game. He played in 3 more events from age 9 to 10. He played in 3 events those 2 years. One of them, he actually finished ninth, I think, in the Houston Champions Tournament. But anyway, long story short, it was my dad's hero growing up. And my dad didn't get to see him very often. He certainly didn't get to see him on television. There wasn't any golf on television. There wasn't even television when my dad was young. So it was my dad's hero. And my dad always, whose work ethic we've already talked about, was incredible. Well, that's what made Ben Hogan set apart. But what was really great about him was that mystical, like, magic that he literally died. I mean, he almost died in a bus accident where a bus hit his car. And it's like, how could he come back and win 6 of the next 9 major championships? That's not possible. So there was a lot of mystique. They call it the Hogan mystique, shrouded in that. And in my young years, there wasn't very much written about him. In the last 25 years, there's been a lot of things documenting what happened during that time. So I was getting little bits and pieces from my dad. And I just think the way he would talk about Ben Hogan was almost in a sheer reverence. It's like, how did this kid who came from abject poverty, who never really had anything going his way and had the war interrupt his career, and then he had a bus accident. I mean, then he wrapped his legs in bandages for the rest of his life while he limped around a golf course. It's like, that's too good to be true. The movie Follow the Sun in 1951 with starred Glenn Ford and Ann Baxter, it really didn't do justice to it. It's a little corny, not quite perfect. I think if you redid the story, Follow the Sun, redid it with modern day acting, and I think you could just do an amazingly inspirational movie about one of the greatest stories in the history of competitive athletics.
There's probably a lot of people that wouldn't believe it, believe that
no
he
way.
went through. And you know what? It's funny. This is a whole story for a different day, but you kind of brought up an interesting point when you talk about the mystique around him, because I feel like in today's world, there may not be as much of that with social media and everything that's out there. And like you're saying, you didn't get to see him on TV. It was kind of like urban legend with a guy like that, that to go through the things he did, it would be so well documented today that there may not be that same mystique, just because everything is so public. But
everything is public. Plus, if you think about it, Hogan was one of the last superstars in competitive athletics who was filmed and photographed in black and white. And I don't really like looking at colorized photos of Ben. I think he looks more natural in black and white. But he also never wore a logo, not one single logo, not even when he was competing in U.S. Opens with the Ben Hogan Company already up and running. He never competed with a logo. Now, I realize that's silly for the modern day. That wouldn't happen. But it's just something more pure about a guy. Now, trust me, he liked making money and he made great investments and he gambled on greyhounds. I mean, he tried to get into the cattle business. He did a lot of he didn't mind making money, trust me, but he didn't want to commercialize things. And he always said, your name is the most valuable asset you have. Do not do anything to cheapen your name. So I just answer your question, Ben Hogan just had a certain grit about him, that doesn't always exist in the modern day. He had a certain overcoming nature. You know, I think anybody who's overcome great adversity to achieve that at that level of success is worth studying and worth talking about.
Well, obviously the results were tremendous. And I don't know if you remember this. We again went down to the Hogan Award. This was the first year I went, and it was Colin Morikawa, Matt Wolf, and Victor Hovland. And, you know, you go in and they give you the tour of the clubhouse.
Mm-hmm.
You go in the room that has his memorabilia and all that stuff. And I remember Alan Bratton texting you.
Yeah.
From the room, we were in the room, and that was when Matt and Victor were looking at his finishes. And if you would have seen the look on their faces when they started going through and looking, and I think they knew he was a good player, obviously, and that he was but then when you really started to look at the numbers, I remember specifically looking at Victor's face as he was reading through that and seeing the accomplishments of that man. And it was, and anyway, when we were talking to them about it, your name came up. And I remember Alan said, well, I'm going to text him right now and tell him where we're standing. And we were standing in the middle of that with all of his memorabilia. But that was, it's always when you see stuff like that, because obviously everybody knows Tiger, but when you see somebody that maybe gains an appreciation for those that came before, you know, because obviously Tiger and Jack are intertwined and people talk about that. But I don't know, maybe I feel like Hogan's name maybe gets lost a little bit sometimes along the way, and you know, true golf will understand. But
when I was still a high school golf coach in the 90s, I used Ben Hogan on everything. When I would give a memo to the kids, there was an image of Ben Hogan on there. I told the stories. I got Ben Hogan signed 17 photographs for my golf team and my assistant coaches and some other people related to the program. I mean, I preached Ben Hogan's career to those kids. Now, I can't do that anymore because it's so far removed. You know, I was 10 years old or 11 years old the last time he teed it up in a golf tournament. So it's like these kids don't even understand that. So I don't use that anymore. But the resilience, the perseverance, the just overall grit that he used was just way old school. And nowadays, if they don't get a massage when they come home from a tournament, they're all, gosh, I don't feel quite right. Are you kidding me? Guys, when things are hard, that's actually very good. It's great when things are hard.
Well, I don't know if you remember this. One year we were at Prairie Dunes and some They Shall Remain Nameless tour pros were going to get a pedicure, and they asked me if I wanted to go. And so you think Ben Hogan would have ever gotten a pedicure after playing 36?
I don't think so. The fact that he continued to play U.S. Opens when they had the U.S. Open Saturday, which is Thursday, Friday, and then Saturday was a 36-hole final. It's unbelievable he could walk 36 holes. It's incredible. So, yeah, it's too far removed for today's kids to, you know, for it to resonate with them. But that kind of grit, if you find it and you capture it today, you're going to beat most opponents. And I've watched on other teams for kids who have grit. I watch for it. You can see it. It screams when the grit does, and they don't say a word. They just go out and do their business and their job. So I think grit is one of the most undervalued competitive advantages in the history of any sport.
Well, you touched on it a minute ago, and as a native, a Mustang, Oklahoma native, it pains me to do this, but I'm going to bring up Edmund.
Okay, do it.
I want to talk about Edmund a little bit. And now, what led you into coaching? And then, you know, you end up at Edmund, which is obviously a powerhouse program here in Oklahoma. And just tell me a little bit about your time there and kind of what steered you to coaching and then getting in and the successes of Edmund.
My dad always said I'd be a great coach, so I give him credit for that. But 3 years of bad mini tour golf got me into coaching. you can't come home with money in your pockets. You know, you got to feed yourself. So that's, in a nutshell, that's basically what it is. I tried playing mini tour golf for 3 years while also being the junior golf director at the golf course. So I was a life in between, if you will. My dad had encouraged me to get into coaching. He thought I'd be good. So I started helping the high school coach, Mark Maids, at Edmund High School, and eventually it transitioned into helping Rick Leith, the coach following him, and then I became the head coach at Edmund North. So my time there was amazing. I wouldn't trade it. In fact, I often tell people some of my best memories in coaching, period, happened right there in Edmund. The kids were teaching me how to be a coach, and all I really had at the time was I was still a good player. I was solid, but I had enthusiasm. And I really wanted to help them. I didn't know how to help them, but I wanted to. So I think enthusiasm and want to went a long way toward our success at Edmund High School and then Edmund North. But I had a lot of people helping. The club pros in the local area were all very helpful. The parents were honestly great parents. They weren't overbearing, but they wanted to support any way they could. And Art Proctor at Kicking Bird was literally a great proponent of junior golf. So we had a lot of things set up and great golf courses in Edmund for success. But, you know, the kids had to hit the shots, and they won, I think, 8 state championships in 10 years that I was there. It was a great time. I'll never trade for that.
I was thinking about this the other night, just, you know, obviously the great success you had there. And you've always told me, you know, growing up in Ponca and growing up in the shadow of this program and, you know, Coach Holder, Labor and Harris, and you've got as great, if not the greatest, appreciation for the history of golf I've ever seen. So you obviously knew as well as anybody, maybe even better than those guys, about the history of Oklahoma State golf. Were there any parallels that you were able to draw from being at a highly successful program at Edmund, then when you transitioned to coming to Oklahoma State to join Coach Holder and come to another highly successful program? Was there anything that carried over between that?
Well, yes, what carried over is at every level, you're playing junior high golf or junior golf. To be a good high school player, you have to be better. And then going from high school to college, you have to be a lot better. Those 10 years that I coached high school golf, only 2 players of mine went to Oklahoma State. Only 2. And if you go to University of Oklahoma and several others to D1 schools. But so we weren't producing players that ended up on their team very often. It was pretty rare, actually. Actually, 3 players up. No, it was 2. It was 2. So they had to get better. So I knew when I jumped in that I was going to be seeing different golf. And I knew that I was going to go to work for an iconic coach in Mike Holder. And so I thought, this is going to be the greatest learning experience of my life. What my wife didn't understand was why I had to take an $18,000 pay cut to do it. Because in those days, they limited it to $16,000 that you could pay an assistant coach in tennis and in golf in college for 2 years. I was a director of instruction at Carston Creek and gave 10 to 15 lessons on a weekend just to make ends meet. But Mike gave me that opportunity and I cherished it because I knew I would learn a lot working for him. Charles Howell III was a freshman when I got there. So I got to, and Boyd Summerhays. So I got to see some great, Bo Van Pelt was a senior on the team. It was good golf right away. And it was way better than I'd been coaching before.
Well, you brought her up, and I can't not bring up your wife, Pam. And somewhere along the way in there, you got married, and life changed for you. You've told me the story of how you lived in a ping golf towel that you used as your.
Well, I lived in a 1-room efficiency apartment with no furniture. I slept on the floor when I rolled up a pink, well, and actually I rolled up a sweatshirt for a pillow, and I I used a long ping beach towel, you know, ping golf beach towel for my blanket. And then when 1992, a kid named Will Moore, who ended up going to TCU and then transferred to Mississippi State, his parents were leaving when he graduated that May, leaving town, moving to Dallas. And they gave me a Barca lounger because they knew I didn't have any furniture. And one night I fell asleep on it. And I thought, woke up the next day very well rested. I thought, God, that feels a lot better than the floor. So I started sleeping in that thing for about 6 or 7 years. And yeah, I was a man of few needs. I didn't have any material possessions that mattered other than golf magazines and golf clubs that I cared about, but I didn't collect anything else. I'm still a minimalist. I know people wouldn't believe that, but I truly am. I don't care to have stuff. And Pam, when we got married, she thought we needed a couch because people have couches in houses, and I just didn't know. Anyway, she has given me amazing perspective, just because it shouldn't always be about the golf coaching and about winning and all that stuff. Sometimes there's other things to life.
So you were as consumed as you were with golf when you did get married. What has she brought to your life? You know, how did she change your life?
Well, again, perspective. You know, when I was at Oklahoma State and drowning in the expectations or whatever I went through there, that was my own fault. And she tried to help me with that. She tried to explain to me that, you know, just keep on doing your best and the results are either going to be good enough or they're not. I couldn't respond to that. But she wrote an email to me as we just missed match play at Nationals. And I was the very next morning at 6 o'clock, I was at Kicking Bird Golf Course recruiting at the state junior. I just couldn't stop working hard enough. And the email that I got during that round basically said, be still, slow down. And she had some scriptures in there that were really wonderful. And that email is still, a copy of it is on the inside front cover of every journal I keep every year for every golf team I've ever coached since. She gave me perspective. She gave me, and her life has given me perspective. She became a diabetic when she was 12. And has fought diabetes her whole life and is now on dialysis. So, you know, to see her every day have to struggle with health issues all through her life. But if you go out to dinner with her, you would never know. She's joking, laughing, having a great time, engaged with the people you remember. I mean, you like her way more than you like me. Let's put it there. And you've made no mistake about that.
She makes Snickers cake for me. What can I say? That's undefeated.
She's a great cook, but her ability, and we talked about Hogan's grit and his perseverance and overcoming adversity, she does that every day. And she's done it every day for over 50 years. So to watch that every time I get a little upset because I'm impatient or whatever it is in my life that I think is hard, I realize she's dealing with a whole lot more than I am. And she's done it for over 50 years. So perspective, and she's just the sweetest girl in the world. And you've been around her a bunch, and you know, she's a big reason for any success I've had.
Well, I know that, you know, obviously with what the battles she's had, she's far tougher than you or I. I know that. And it was in 2018 when you all came to town for Nationals. That was one of the highlights of that tournament for me, was the fact that I got to spend time with her. And I know that she had been going through it, and it was, I never told you this, but I remember her, you guys were out on the golf course, and, you know, I don't get to, when you host one of those things, you don't really get to go watch much golf. And I saw her, she came walking up the cart path, and I was absolutely thrilled. And it just, that she was out walking the golf course.
And she walked the whole back nine that day.
And I remember her coming up, and I didn't tell her this, but it was just amazing to me. I thought, man, with all she's going through, and she's out there walking the golf course, and that really struck me. And I was just really glad that she got to be out there with you and do that. I know that wasn't obviously the funnest week for you guys, but to get to spend
it was a
time.
Fun week for you guys, though. You had a great week that week.
Well, yeah, it was okay. You know, we finally got over the hump on that one, but that was absolutely, getting to see her and her be there with you was one of the highlights of that week for me. And you talked about, obviously, with what you went through here, and because I've never really asked you this. I mean, we talked a lot about the expectations at Oklahoma State and what comes with the program here. But the word I think that comes to mind when I think, so you take over for Coach Holder. And to me, that takes a lot of guts. Guts is the word What was that like? And again, I'm going to go back to this. Growing up in Ponca City and being a golf historian, you knew everything that the program was about. You knew the expectations. What was that like for you to take over as the head coach here?
Well, it was a great source of pride. My New York Yankees job, it was like I never dreamed I'd get it. I was told by Mike I wouldn't get it. And when he became the athletic director, I was his first hire as an athletic director. So there was pride, but there was also a great amount of trepidation knowing, what if I mess this up? What if I screw up? What if it doesn't work? What if I can't recruit? What if I'm not, you know, all those self-doubts you have. I was very fortunate that I had a really good team that year that Mike had left me. So we were able to, you know, get our way to a national championship that year. It wasn't easy, but it happened. And that kind of solidified things. And then I had two incredible recruiting classes right in a row, which kind of, you know, guaranteed us that we were going to be pretty good for another 4 or 5 years, in which we were. But I think the fact that, and I said this when I got fired in 2013, a reporter was trying to goad me into saying something bad about OSU or about Mike Holder or whatever. And I said, well, you know what? When I got the job, he told me, Mike, I told you I'd never give you this job, but I'm giving it to you because you're ready and I think you can do a great job. He said, but I want you to understand two things. One, the expectations are unfair and the expectations are unrealistic, both. Now you still want the job. And I said, absolutely. I want this job. I think I can do some good here. So I went in eyes wide open. Mike didn't hide anything from me. And when he let me go in 2013, I thanked him that very same day because I'll never forget, Sports Information Director Kevin was in that meeting. And so I looked at the press release and I said, that looks great, Mike. And I stood up and I said, I want to thank you for 16 great years. This has been an amazing experience. I'm sad it's over, but it's been one of the greatest experiences that I'll ever have in coaching. And Kevin just had this dumbfounded look on his face. And it was like, if I couldn't respect Mike's decision to go another direction, even though a lot of my friends and family were unhappy about it, and I was shocked by it, but it was like, if I couldn't respect it after all he had done for this program and after all the success had been, you know, it's like I had to respect it. But I also, if I was going to be a good coach afterward, going forward, I needed also to forgive him. And I did. And it was like, that was the greatest thing I could ever do for myself, was to forgive Mike and say thank you for that. So forgiveness is one of the strongest things you can do. It looks humble, it looks vulnerable, but it's really a strong thing. And so I was able to do that. And I think I've thrived the last 10 years because been in a better place because of that. So I appreciate everything Mike did for me. Yeah, I didn't want to leave, but I'm happy. I'm loving it here at Baylor.
It's funny you say that, because I don't know if I ever told you about this. So I believe that was a Friday, I believe.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And I was, of all things, I was in the arena that day. We were hosting a wrestling event. I think it was an international freestyle or something. I don't remember what the in it. So I was working the wrestling event, and of all things, I come running back up. You know, our offices are here in the building. I come upstairs and we had run out of paper or toner for the printer or something down there. So I'd run up here to get supplies to take back down there. And I didn't know what was going on. And Kevin was in his office and he called me in and you guys had just left. And he told me about that meeting. And I could tell he was just amazed at how it went down. And I don't know if you knew this or not, but after you walked out of the room and he told me this, that he asked Coach Holder, he said, well, what do you think Coach McGraw will do? And Coach Holder said this, he said, that man can go do anything he wants to do.
So, I've never heard that. Thank
you. So, yeah, he was right. And he sat me down and he wrote that press release and he saved me one. He said, I knew that you and Coach were friends. And he goes, I didn't want to have you have to do this. I took care of it for you. Because I told him, I said, I honestly don't think I could have done it. So I appreciated him doing that. But we talked briefly and then doing what we do, he put me back to work. I had to go back downstairs and talk about single legs and takedowns and all that stuff for John Smith, you know. But you've had a lot of successes along the way. And it's funny because I'm tied a little bit in my own weird way to 2000 NCAAs. I remember one of my favorite things you used to do for me as a broke college kid. That's when I was, you would invite me and Brad Schiller, our buddy, our Australian tennis coach, you would take care of us and have us over for dinner. And I remember you guys winning NCAAs in 2000, and you had us over for dinner and told stories about winning NCAAs in 2000. And then there was 2006, and I don't know if you remember this or not, and Zach Robinson denies it to this day, that mm-hmm. I had taken on the nickname the Black Cloud of Death, because I had traveled to NCAAs and we couldn't get over the hump. And you guys are in Oregon. And so that day, the last day, all I had was Golfstat. You remember, there was no TV of any kind. And so I'm in the office and I'm pacing. And Jonathan Moore is playing his last hole, and it feels like it's taking 2 hours. Then they will not post this score. And I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, oh my gosh, he's hit it in the water. He's done. What are we doing? I'm taking laps around the building. And finally come back and I see that score go up and realize that it happened. So I called you to congratulate you, and we talked, and I was getting quotes from you guys, and you handed the phone to Zach Robinson so I could talk to him. And he goes, well, you know why we won? He said, you're 2,000 miles away. It's the Black Cloud of Death wasn't there. And then in 2014, when you were at Alabama, I don't know if you remember this or not, but right when you guys beat us, I was one of the first people right there, and you gave me a hug, and I congratulated you and you thanked me. So I was around for, I had a little bit of a tie to all three of those. You know, I was just getting started in 2000. 2006 was the first time, you know, I got to be around that. So what are your recollection of those high points, I guess, on the golf course, those three national championships that you got?
Well, the first one in 2000, you couldn't hardly look at that tournament not think of Charles Howell III. He bogeyed the first two holes of the first round and played the rest of the tournament 25 under par, set the NCAA record by 6 shots, Phil Mickelson's record, and won the tournament by 8 against guys that were really good, Matt Kuchar and a bunch of guys that would go on to play the PGA Tour. I want to think about Landry Mahan, who finished 13th in that event. Most people, that's an undervalued thing. He actually stepped up and played great golf that week when we needed him. And we wanted a playoff, so we needed every stroke that he saved us. I think Landry was an underrated guy. But I remember when Charles shot 63 the third round, I remember standing on the 18th green having just watched J.C. DeLeon putt out, and you could see through the trees over to 16T. And 16 was a par 4 that you could hit a 5-iron and a sand wedge. And I'm looking at Charles and Mike Holder in through the binoculars, and they're talking back and forth. And Charles has out a 5-iron, and Mike's shaking his head. And I knew it was an iron. I didn't know what club, but I figured it was a 5-iron. And so I'm watching this from 500 yards away almost. And finally, Charles takes the head cover off and knocks the driver right in the middle of the green and makes an eagle and ends up shooting 63 that round. And I remember thinking to myself, okay, that was a pivotal moment. And we won the national championship that year because Charles eagled that hole twice that week, drive the green, make a putt, and birdied it one other day. But I think of that. I think of Charles getting up and down on the last hole, which was amazing. But I also think about when we won, I called Pam. And then I think I texted or called you, and I said, this is unbelievable. A little Ponca City, Oklahoma guy is actually going to hold a national championship trophy today. I couldn't believe it. And I knew I was at one of the best schools to get that to happen. But it was a moment. I remember thinking, this is amazing. I don't know if I'll ever get to experience it again. And then when we hosted in 2003, I thought we should have won that year. We had every chance to win that year and didn't do it. But in 2006, when we won, I'll remember three things. One, how nervous Pablo was in the back nine. He had never played nervous, and he was scared to death. I remember Trent Leon shooting a final round 69, which he had not counted one shot all week long. We had to have his 69 to win that day, and he shot it. The smile on Zach Robinson's face was ear to ear when he was holding that national championship trophy. And then the embrace with Jonathan Moore, who had a year earlier was averaging 80. And now he's won 3 consecutive tournaments, was 34 under par the last 3 tournaments, and won a national championship. Great memory there. In 2014, the obvious memory is I was at Alabama, not at Oklahoma State, and I was coaching against 4 players I'd coached the year before and one I'd recruited to get to Oklahoma State, Zach Olson. But And then the love and affection I had developed for the Alabama kids was strong. So I'm standing there in between 10 guys and I'm thinking to myself, wow, I don't think this will ever happen again in a career. Definitely not my career. And we beat Oklahoma State that day. And Trey Mullinex made the putt to beat Ian Davis in the match. And Ian Davis was like a son to me. And I just remember thinking to myself, I cried for both teams that day because it's like, wow, this is never going to happen again in my career. And it was an amazing moment. I've cried tears of sadness for the Oklahoma State guys because I loved them. And obviously tears of joy for the Alabama guys. So those are the, you know, memories I have of those three tournaments that stand out, like, you know, stations on the cross, if you will, like moments in time you remember. Definitely remember all those.
It's funny that you bring up that 2014 because I remember that vividly. We did the trophy presentation what there was on 10 tee box, right?
Yes.
And I took a picture on my phone because they had both teams stand up there together. And I remember specifically, you know, our guys were obviously distraught, upset. And I remember seeing the look on your face and seeing you process, you know, you had a connection to every one of those guys up there. And that just being, I thought the same thing. I was like, man, this is probably, I can't see anything like this ever happening again. And I've got that photo, but I also remember that week. And I don't know if you remember this, but it was earlier. It wasn't the championship match. It was earlier in the week. It was before one of the stroke play days. I'd come in the clubhouse to eat breakfast and we had the table next to your guys and Jay and all the guys were there. You were there. And I sit down. And so you said something to the table and said, guys, that's Ryan Cameron. He's the sports information director at Oklahoma State. And you said something else about that. And those guys all got up and came over and shook my hand and said they were glad to meet me. But then when they talked about you, just to hear the way they talked about you, and I could tell the impact that you made on them in just a short time. You weren't at Alabama long, but it just really struck me the effect. And I wasn't surprised at all, but the effect that you had on that program in your short time there was amazing. It was remarkable to listen to those guys talk about you that morning at breakfast. And I know you were sitting at the table and they were coming over to me, so you didn't hear what they were saying, but they all got up and came over and shook my hand and said something about you. And a lot of them were actually, thanks for gifting him to us. And I told him and I said, don't screw it up and take care of him, was I kept telling him. But that kind of leads me into, you've had obviously the successes, you've had a very successful career, but it's so much more than that to you. It's not about the trophies and a lot of that stuff. What are you most proud of during your coaching career?
I think when a former player texts me to say my wife just had a baby, or calls me up and asks advice about something, or that stuff sounds a little corny, sounds a little too cliche. Oh, he's going to say something, buttons and bows and butterflies and flowers and sweet, you know, but it's true. You don't really know what kind of team you are coaching until they've been out of college for 10, 15, 20 years, because then you find out what kind of people they become. And so that to me is the most important thing. We can't control the result. If I could have controlled the result this week in Houston, we'd have won by 20 or 50 or 100. And we finished eighth in the tournament. But it doesn't mean that I don't love or respect or have affection for the players I'm coaching. I just want them to play better. They want to play better. But we can't control that part. Boy, I can sure control a lot of other things. How I respond to what they shot this week, or how I speak to them when we talk about it. You know, I was pretty upset after the 36-hole day because we didn't play well. And I thought we could have given a different effort. Yeah, not necessarily work harder, but we could have done something different. And I let the guys know about it. And they understood that's not acceptable. But anyway, that's a long-winded answer. I think it's just the relationships you build last forever. The trophies kind of get on shelves, even though I love winning trophies and it's wonderful. It doesn't last forever like a relationship will.
I want to, and I've told you this before, this is going to be kind of a two-part one. I know we're probably coming up short on time here a little bit, so I want to try to fit as many of these in here as I can. I know everybody talks about, you know, when everything switched to match play and everything that went on. And I don't know how many times I've told you, I was so, yes, it was disappointing to not win, but I will forever, just eternally be grateful at the hall of players that you brought in, the Peter Uihlein's, Morgan Hoffman's, the Ricky Fowler's, Kevin Tway, you know, that list goes on and on, that list of guys that you had. And because I got to know those guys personally and become friends with them. And it, like you said, yeah, it was disappointing to not finish it off, but I'm forever grateful that because of you, you know, personally, I have relationships with those guys. Talk a little bit about that. I mean, just that you brought in guys, they were high level talent, but they're also good people. You were able to get kind of the, you know, the unicorn of bringing in great people that have gone on to do great things in golf, but they're good people off the golf course. What, you know, kind of what went into that? And you look back on that, how proud are you of that, that you were able to do that?
Well, I think it's when you get down to it, anybody can be a complete jerk as they win, but it takes really kind of somebody that's pretty special to beat you in a match or a tournament, and you still have a great amount of respect for him, even though he beat you, because of who they are. I think if Victor Hovland wins a tournament and birdies the last three holes to beat a certain player, that player's going to go, well, that's a pretty great human being right there. And I'll never forget Ricky Fowler, when we were in the locker room after losing at Inverness to Georgia. I've never seen Ricky that distraught about anything. I mean, completely gutted. And he, for a couple of reasons. One, he came to Oklahoma State to win championships. And number two, we had fallen short both years he was there. And number three, he knew he was going to turn pro that next fall. So he knew that was his last chance out the window. And he was gutted. So I love the fact he cared that much. I love the fact that he cared that much. And some people would say, well, if he cared, he would have come back. No, he was ready to be a pro golfer. He was ready. And he thought he was going to get it done in 2 years, and we just didn't get it done. But he cared a lot. Peter Uihlein cared a lot about what he was doing, sometimes to his own detriment. He would work so hard. Kevin Tway, very much the same. You know, Kevin Tway was born a cowboy. He was always going to be a cowboy. It didn't matter. And then Morgan Hoffman, just the fact that, you know, I look back and one of the sweetest moments with Morgan Hoffman, there's two memories. One, when we got out to Court of All, pulled in the parking lot, there's this mountain right next to the parking lot. And he said, Coach McGraw, you and I are climbing that. So after the second round, the night before the last round, we climbed it to the top, took a photo, that picture. And then his mother crying when I handed her his academic All-American plaque. She never dreamed he could do it, and he got it. And I just think about, you know, Morgan's one of the sweetest guys you'll ever meet in your life. He's an amazing guy. But Sean Einhaus, who gets very little mention, he made the famous putt to send his Augusta State match to a playoff. But Sean is one of the great human beings that ever played college golf. And he didn't play at a level where you'd remember his name very often. But when you get to coach a guy like Sean Einhaus, you know it's pretty special.
It's funny that you bring up Sean, and I don't think I've ever told you this, and this is probably, you were in the moment, and you probably don't remember this, but that when he made that putt and that roar went up and you guys loaded up on the golf cart and you loaded the golf cart and I was right there by the side of the green that day. And I knew, I knew you wanted to win, but I remember the look on your face getting on that golf cart. I'd never seen the competitive juices in you the way they were that day, the way you loaded up. And I was like, man, Coach McGraw is the nicest guy in the world, but I'll tell you what, he's going to compete too. And you could just, you can tell a competitor, and I will never forget that as you guys loaded up that cart to head back out to 14. But so we talk about all these guys that you brought in, and I don't know if you remember this either. This is when you were still officing in Gallagher, and I was just getting started. You were the assistant coach for Coach Holder, and you were recruiting Hunter Mahan.
Uh-huh.
And I knew that it was you had kind of kept me, you know, here, I'm green, snot-nosed kid. I didn't know what I was doing. Now I'm an old snot-nosed guy that still doesn't know what I'm doing. But at that time, I didn't know how a lot of this stuff worked. And you had told me, hey, it's going to come down to, you know, probably what, us and USC. And so I come down to your office to see you one day, and you were kind of disappointed. And he had chosen USC. And so my first thought was, well, to heck with that kid. And I said, so what did you do? And I don't know if you remember this, but you told me, Well, I wrote him a letter and just thanked him for the opportunity to recruit him. And we look forward to competing and, you know, wished him the best of luck. And I was trying to wrap my mind around that at the time. I'm thinking, how can you be, I mean, you obviously took the high road. And so I learned a lesson that day and how to handle, that wasn't necessarily a failure, but you didn't necessarily win that one. And the way you handled that, I think I really learned a lesson that day. And that ended up coming back to benefit you in the future, did it not?
It did. Hunter, when he was not happy for whatever reason at Southern Cal, I don't think he liked living in a city, and he had been in a car accident trying to get to the range or the course or something. You know, he opened up, he got his release, and he only called Oklahoma State. He wanted to come to Oklahoma State. We wanted him desperately in the recruiting process. But I did learn early on that when you lose, that's a moment. The moment you lose, I mean, you're either first or last in recruiting. There is no second place, because first is the only place that matters in recruiting. You get the guy. And when you lose a marquee player like that, you'd spent 2.5 years as an assistant coach and Mike Holder the same as the head coach, you're gutted. It's like unbelievable, because you put all that effort in and the kid decided to go someplace else. But that's a moment in time. And I tell all young coaches, there's the defining moment right there. Yeah, you're saying, well, the defining moment was if I'd have done something different in recruiting, we'd have got him. No, that's not, you can't control that. But you can control how you're going to handle this disappointment. And he'll never forget it as long as he lives. If he had loved it at Southern Cal and been a first-team All-American out there and been on a tour player, he would still have had good things to say about Oklahoma State and Mike Holder and Mike McGraw. So I just tell young coaches, you got to figure out how that moment is going to be. And it just doesn't mean that you're hoping he'll come back to your school after a release. It means that if somebody goes to him and says, you know, my son's 14 and he's going to get in, wants to play college, where would you consider? Well, Southern Cal was where I played, so that was a good place. But Mike McGraw, you know, Oklahoma State, maybe he's the guy. So, and here's the reason, because he handled the adversity really, really well. You're going to lose in recruiting a bunch. So I tell young coaches, lose as well as you can possibly lose, even though you're punching the wall, you know, even though you're losing sleep or whatever, make sure that kid knows you appreciated that he allowed you to recruit him and evaluate him and try to get him to campus. It's an important moment for a coach.
It's funny. And I know that's part of what coaching entails. I'm going to try to make this quick. I know you probably got to go. I've got three more things for you.
Go ahead.
This is going to sound maybe like a simpleton question, because I get this one a lot. You know, people, when they go to sporting events and they've probably either grown up playing, you know, football, basketball, they know what a football basketball coach does. And I get asked all the time, and I don't know that I've come up with a great answer. What goes in, what all does being a college golf coach entail? Because you guys do things a little bit differently. You know, you have organized, regimented practices in football, or, you know, and sometimes, like you mentioned, having your guys go out and do their individual practices, but, and some of them have their own swing coach. So just kind of, if you can, walk me through what being a college golf coach, everything that kind of goes into that, if you can wrap that into a nutshell.
There's also the fundraising part you haven't mentioned is a big part of college golf coaching for sure. But getting to know their swing instructor while you're recruiting them, and then after you sign them, so that you can speak the same language, that's a big thing. Helping them manage their time. If you ever talk to a collegiate athlete who becomes a professional, say, oh yeah, he's giving advice, he's going to tell a young kid, time management's really hard. So you're teaching them skills there. When you walk with them on the golf course, you're finding out how they think and how they react to stuff. So you're learning there, so you help them there. You're making suggestions on a daily basis. I'll never forget Mike Holder said something to Charles Howell, and I thought, well, he was kind of rough on Charles. I'm going to ask a question. Why'd you say that? He said, Mike, I may not always say the right thing, but I have to say something to change the direction he's headed. And it was something very small, but it was something Mike wanted to get a point across. And I didn't understand that concept. Coaches do a lot of that. You're trying to redirect their thinking, or they're put them on the right path with what you say and how you say it. Main thing is I want to be an example for them. And if I can do that, I think I've got a chance for them to jump on board. They need to know you care. So you're a sports psychologist a little bit, because you're trying to get in their head and and trying to help them through rough times, if you will. And rough times, very, very relative term, if you will. It's a lot of first world problems there that you have on a college golf team. But so you're everything from a swing coach to a recruiter, to a fundraiser, to a sports psychologist, to just a mentor or sort of a friend, not really friend, but definitely mentor. There's a lot of hats you wear. Just do the best you can when you put the next hat on.
When I've made trips for basketball to Waco, I've been to your facility, I think, 3 times now.
Okay.
And you come pick me up and we get to go hang out in your office, and you've built a beautiful, beautiful facility there. When you took the job at Baylor, what was it about Baylor that was appealing to you? And you know, to me, it looks like you're able to, that's a program you're able to come in and you're going to put your stamp on it. Like I said, you built the facility and some of that, but what was it about Baylor that was appealing to you?
Well, it's a small campus. I always thought Oklahoma State was fairly small. You know, if you take out the agriculture part of it and the animal sciences part of it, the campus was pretty small, you know, Oklahoma State in general. So I love that about Waco. Baylor is not a big campus. I love being back in the Big 12 conference, which is great. And the climate's a little better than it was in Stillwater. I don't mean to negatively recruit. I just mean to say it is different down here. It's a lot better climate as far as that, but we still have 4 distinct seasons and we do have wind, which is great. So I love that. Yeah. I like being in Texas. I do miss Oklahoma, no doubt, but I've really enjoyed my time here, and the faith part of the institution was pretty important to me too. I thought that was great. At Oklahoma State, really not allowed to share your faith unless somebody asks, but you know, at a private institution you can. So a lot of good things. It's different. We didn't have the same history as Oklahoma State had when I got here. Tried to create some as I've gone along here. I think we've been good, but I think we can be a whole lot better.
Hey, you've got a swinging bear now. You got that done, right?
So we do have a swinging bear. We get to compete in that little guy. That's great.
I've got a list of stuff that I'm having to cross off that we're not going to be able to get to because I know you've got to get
going. We'll do a part two.
We need to. And I'm going to leave you with this. You and I have talked about this, and anybody that sees anything I do on social media knows of my great affection for our man Ricky.
Yep.
And just what, you know, you and I talk all the time about him and what he's done for golf and that sort of stuff. So he got inducted last fall into our Hall of Honor. And so when he came to town, he and I, it was funny, he and I actually got to do a sit down, and I told him, I said, you know, I've essentially known you for what, 18 years, 14 years, whatever, 16, whatever it is now. And I said, we had never done a sit down. And when we were going, he goes, yeah, you're right, it's time to do this. And one of the things I asked him, because, and you know, I love to play golf and I'm just decent enough to be dangerous, but I've always had a great respect for those of you that put the peg in the ground, tee it up, and then have to sign your name for a score. Mm-hmm. Because I've never done that. I've never done it. And I have a great respect for those of you that sign your name next to a number. And I try to tell people all the time how hard the game is. And I told him, I said, in your words, tell me how hard is the game? Because people are like, you know, they're always, well, why doesn't he win? Why doesn't this guy win? Why didn't he win a green jacket? Well, it's like, it's just that simple. And he said, he made an interesting point to me. He goes, Ryan, even when I was at my lowest point, when he got to what was it, 180 in the world or whatever it was, he goes, I'm not going to sit here and tell you I was playing great. But he goes, I was closer than you think. And he said, I was a little bit off. And he goes, these guys out here are so good that even if you're just a fraction off, you get exposed and you get lapped.
Mm-hmm.
And that was his way of telling me how difficult life is on the PGA Tour. So I want to ask you that same question that I asked him when we talk about how hard winning in the game of golf. You know, they only give out one trophy, and you go to the U.S. Open, there's what, 156 guys in the field, and there's one trophy. So you essentially feel like 155 guys are going to leave there not happy. But how just in your words, how hard is the game of golf? Because I think it's the hardest game there is out there.
Well, it is a hard game because there's too much downtime for a human being, and your mind wanders and it goes all different terrible places your mind goes. It's more mental than it is physical, and it's very physical. So the skills it takes to hit a golf ball, to get up and down, to do all the things you have to do to be a great player, it's very physical, but it's more mental than it is physical. and that drives it, weighs on you. And now with social media, in the old days, Ricky could have hidden, you know, in that downtime when he wasn't playing well, he could have kind of hidden and nobody would have said anything or whatever. But nowadays, it's every day. And they're always asking, what's wrong with him? What's wrong with him? Well, I would say if you took Jack Nicklaus, Tiger Woods, Phil Mickelson, you could name another handful of other players that coming out of college would say, no, I don't think I'd take Ricky's career. I think I can do better. Or, you know, if you didn't put Ricky's name on it, you just put these are the results. Would you take that? But 99% of the players coming out of college would say that's an incredible career. Three or four Ryder Cups, three or four President's Cups, win six or seven times, win around the world, all those top tens in majors. Well, yeah, that's fantastic. I'd say the same for Charles Howell. He's won three times, two President's Cups, 17 runner-up finishes. He's made $50 million playing golf. Most people say that's fantastic. That's how hard it is. It's so hard that the two guys that I just described their careers are thought of, oh, they underachieved. What do you mean they underachieved? What are you talking about? There's all kinds of great players out there. It's not easy. It's that way in college golf. This week, there's a young man that plays for Sam Houston State. His name is Brett Gray, and he was overlooked by all the Texas schools. And Brant Kieschnick signed him, and that kid's done nothing but get better. And he tied for first this week in our golf tournament at Houston. I'm telling you, it's hard. It's not easy to win. It's not easy to win. So if I just mentioned Charles Howell and Ricky Fowler, you're going, wow, those are great careers. But people look at it and say no. And I think social media is the problem. That's not the problem, but it exacerbates the problem.
It does. It's funny because I've always told you, I remember we used to talk about Charles too all the time. And I said, well, if that's underachieving, sign me up for it because I would love to be an underachiever. So,
for sure.
And I always do this too. I always tell people, look at the Corn Ferry Tour. I can pull up the leaderboard on the Corn Ferry Tour and I can say, I remember that guy in college. He was an All-American. That guy was a two-time All-American. This guy was here, did this. I can go down the list of those guys and those guys aren't even on tour. I try to explain to people that don't follow it as closely as, obviously, it's your livelihood, and I follow it because I love it. And so to see those guys, I have a great respect for that, how deep it is, how many good players it is, and how just on a weekly basis, how hard it is. You know, and you look at this past week with the Tour Championship, look at Xander Schauffele.
Mm-hmm.
He just said, well, I'm runner-up again. You know, put that in my pocket and take it with me because I feel like he's kind of followed the path of some of those other guys. He's had a great career, but, you know, and he played great, and look what happened. And just how hard it is to get over the finish line it is. And just because you didn't win the trophy didn't mean you weren't successful.
Yeah, I don't know. I think people, it gets out of balance. I mean, yeah, we're all trying to win every week we tee it up, but only one wins. So that can't be the only measure of success, winning.
I appreciate that. And I appreciate you and everything you've done for me. I appreciate you letting me do this and grill you for an hour. So I hope everybody's still awake by the end of this. And I've still got a list of stuff that we could do it again. You just say the word and you tell me when you want to let me bother you again, and I'd do it in a heartbeat.
Why don't we do it sometime this summer? I'd love, this was good. I got to actually talk. When I do a podcast, I don't want to hear my voice. I want to hear the guest. So I'm going to get to hear myself this time. We'll see how it turned out.
Well, again, I appreciate you letting me do it, and I appreciate everything you've done for me. Have we really known each other 25 years?
I think so. You were just a young kid out of Mustang that used to play some pretty good baseball. But yeah,
well, I was,
and you hit a terrific slice on a golf ball, by the way.
You fixed that for me. I've got the notepad. You gave my one golf lesson I've had was on a yellow legal pad, and you did that for me, and I haven't sliced it since. That's just how magical you are, and that adds to the legend of you being a five-town legend, right?
Yeah, well, you can be a legend for a lot of reasons, Ryan.
Well, I appreciate you doing it, Coach. Thanks for letting me do this today.
Absolutely. I appreciate it. And hopefully we'll see you at Whispering Pines if you're down there watching the golf team.
That'd be great.
All right. Thanks, Ryan.